All right, so with that, let's proceed to item nine, which is a presentation regarding our disability retirement process. And I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Tim Hoppe. So Tim, the floor is yours.
Okay, let's give a moment while they bring the presentation up on your screens. Here we go. Okay, we're going to go through a disability retirement overview. And if we move on to slide two, you know, general principles on the disability retirement is the CSERA members who are permanently incapacitated. And again, we're ensuring that they are, you know, it's a permanent condition, may be entitled to a disability retirement. And in all cases, permanent incapacity for the performance of duty shall be determined by the Board of Retirement. So just setting a little bit of framework in what we do, and I know you're all familiar with it. Can we move to slide three? There's two types of disability retirement, service-connected and non-service-connected. Service-connected means the member became permanently ill or injured as a result of performing their job duties, versus non-service means it was not, employment did not contribute to the member's incapacity. We do have some different rules, and they're the same whether it's service-connected or non-service-connected. If you're in the safety tier, tier one or tier four, you must be unable to perform your usual and customary job. If you're tier three or tier five, there's a much higher standard and you must be unable to engage in any substantial gainful employment. On slide four, we're going to talk about the safety tier one and tier four disability benefits. The service-connected disability benefit is 50% of the highest final 12 months average salary. It could be 36 months if you're in safety C or PEPRA tier four, and up to 100% of the retirement allowance could not be taxable. In all cases, the applicant would receive the better of the two calculations, whether it's 50% or if a service retirement provided a greater benefit, then a portion would be carved out as non-taxable. For non-service connected, it's a taxable benefit, and it's one-third of the highest 12 months or 36 months, depending upon which tier the individual is in. And again, if the service retirement is greater, we would use the service retirement calculation. On slide five, highlights the disability retirement benefit for tiers three and five. And you'll notice from the last slide, the percentages are different for service connected and for non-service connected. The benefit is 40% of the final 36 months of final average salary. Plus, there could be a benefit for minor children or the regular service retirement. And similar, if it's service connected, up to 100% of the retirement allowance could not, maybe non-taxable, where on the non-service, it's a taxable benefit. On slide six, the eligibility to file an application, again, depending upon what tier you're in, it's different. If it's service connected, you can file an application at any time during employment. Under non-service connected, this is where we end up with some different rules or eligibility requirements. If you're safety tier one or tier four, it's 5 years of service to apply for a non-service connected disability. And if you're tier three or tier five, you must complete 10 years of service. On slide seven, when can a disability application be filed? Well, normally we'll see what happens is it's while the member is in service or within 4 months after the member has discontinued service. We have had in some rare instances within 4 months after the expiration of any period which a presumption is extended beyond the member's discontinuance of service, or while from the date of discontinuance of service to the time of application, he or she is continuously physically or mentally incapacitated to perform his or her duties. On slide 8, this is an important key point. The burden of proof is on the applicant, or if the applicant is deceased, on the beneficiary. An applicant must prove the existence of a permanent incapacity by the preponderance of the evidence to the Board of Retirement and to the courts. In the case of a lot of the service-connected disabilities, as a convenience, CESARA will do outreach to the work comp carrier, risk management in the case of the county, to secure medical records from them. In the case of a non-service connected disability, CESARA does not have direct access to those records, and they need to be supplied by the applicant. On slide 9, we have the presumptions, and these apply to the safety members. And safety members, in the case of a presumption, are relieved of the burden of proving their illness arose out of and in the course of their employment when a presumption applies. But permanent incapacity must still be proven with medical evidence, and the presumptions are rebuttable. And the four that apply specifically to safety members is the heart, cancer, bloodborne infectious disease, and biochemical substance presumptions. We also have a temporary presumption for COVID-19 that expires currently at the end of, or January 1 of 2024. It was extended for a year, and that applies, depending upon the case, to multiple positions health services. It can apply in a general office if there's an outbreak, but it's much more global as far as who the presumption applies to. On slide 10 is the disability application review. So when the application is complete, meaning we have the application, all of the information, all of the medicals we need, we prepare them and provide them to the board's medical advisor. The medical advisor then will make a preliminary recommendation based upon the information they have received, summarizing the evidence or the absence of evidence supporting the recommendation or not. On slide 11 is once the medical advisor submits their report or recommendation back to CESARA, you know, there generally can be two different recommendations or two different responses. If the medical advisor's preliminary recommendation is to grant the application, the matter is placed on the agenda for the board to consider it. Those are the ones that you see on a regular basis when we do the agendas. These are the recommendations that were recommended as grants by the medical advisor. The ones that the board generally doesn't see are the ones as if the medical advisor is unable to recommend granting the application. They're not denying it. They're just unable to recommend granting the application based on the evidence submitted. CESARA staff will advise the applicant that he or she, you know, they have two options, three options, I guess. The first option is submit additional medical or other evidence in support of the application that will be forwarded to the medical advisor, or request a hearing before a hearing officer within 6 months of the date of our notification, informing them that the medical advisor was unable to recommend granting the application. And really the third one would be, is if the applicant does not take any action, and we have seen it happen, the application is closed 6 months after the date of notice of the medical advisor's recommendation that they are unable to grant. On slide 11 is the hearing process. So now we'll have an individual where the hearing or the medical advisor could not recommend a grant, and the applicant has requested a hearing. So we'll file, the case will be filed with the Office of Administrative Hearings. We're using the Oakland branch. The case is heard by an administrative law judge. Following that hearing, the ALJ will issue a report and recommendation to the board. And the recommendation, the board does see all of those reports, whether it's a recommendation to grant or a recommendation to deny. All parties are provided with the report and they have an opportunity to respond to the proposed recommendation. Based upon the timeframes that are laid out to, you know, providing proper notice and time to respond, it's placed on the board agenda. And then the final determination resides with the board. On slide 13, this highlights the options that are available or actions that the board can take. The board will consider the proposed findings of fact and recommended decision on a date notice to all parties. Any party or his or her counsel may request the opportunity to make an oral presentation to the board. And this is key. No new evidence or witness testimony may be heard or received by the board. And then the board has four actions it can take. Approve and adopt the proposed findings and recommendation of the hearing officer, or refer the matter back to the hearing officer for further proceedings with or without instructions, or require a transcript or summary of all of the testimony plus all other evidence received by the hearing officer. And after receipt thereof, the board shall take such action as it determines is warranted by the evidence. And lastly, the board could set the matter for a hearing before itself. At such hearing, the board shall hear and decide the matter as if it had not been referred to the hearing officer.
So yeah. I'll just comment. Hey, Tim, let me just jump in and comment. I think during the time that I've been a member of the board, we have taken up actions numbers 1, 2, and 3 on differing occasions based on the circumstances. But to my recollection, we have not engaged in a de novo hearing in front of the board or just a hearing in front of the board itself. Am I correct?
The time that I've been with Cesera, that's my understanding also. Okay. Generally, we have done, we've one and two have been probably the ones that the board has used, the actions taken by the board. I believe on number three, maybe twice.
Right.
The board has the transcript and all of the testimony, and those were some very rare and complicated cases.
Yeah, I think you're right. I showed two in the time that I've been on the board. Yeah.
Yeah. Now that concludes the, disability retirement overview and the process taken. Open it up to questions. We're also going to be going through the semi-annual disability report.
Right. That's our next item 10. So on item 9, are there questions or comments for Tim? That was a good, nice summary. Just to remind us all of the tiers, the circumstances, the requirements for each. Nice summary. Of course, we just had hearings today, of course. So it's fresh in our mind.
Yeah.
I don't have everybody up in my gallery. Okay.
I have Louis, Samson, Dennis, and Jerry have their hands up.
Wow, you are seeing a lot more than I. So take them in that order. It's however you want to proceed.
All right, Louis, you're on top.
Hey, Tim, just a quick question. A hearing, they still, if we denied judges, we go to judge's recommendation to deny, they still could go to Superior Court for a hearing. Is that true still?
Yeah, that is still true. And I'm trying to think in, the 7 years or so, I've encountered it once or twice in the 7 year period.
I just want to make sure they still got that option because when we deny it.
Correct. Yes, they do. Samson.
Hi. Yeah, actually a couple questions. So going back to slide 7, so when can applications be filed? So is there anything, 4 months, is that arbitrary or is there something significant about the 120 days?
This is from our policy.
Right. No, I'm just curious if there was anything significant about the 4 month mark, or is 4 months just an arbitrary length of time someone can file a disability retirement?
I think it gives them time. We've had to have individuals that will service retire, and at the same time, they're trying to get their paperwork together to file, because go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not, you know, it's like doing a retirement application. You kind of fill out one piece of paper. The application for disability is about 15 pages long. Other documents need to be attached, but the core of it is a 15-page document, and the key piece is the external medical report that supports the permanency and the restriction of the for the applicant.
Okay. No, I was just curious if there was anything significant about that time frame. And then secondly, a couple slides later, with regards to the heart ring presumptive, do we distinguish between like something that falls under electrical versus something that's mechanical or structural with the heart, or it just all gets lumped in there?
You're making me think here, and if Karen is available or Allison, they may have also feedback on it.
So you're talking it's actually a very good question. So are you talking about things like stents, valves, in addition to heart disease? Is that your question?
Right. Yeah. Like heart disease versus, let's say, PVCs, you know, I know medically they kind of distinguish between the two. So I'm just wondering, for the purposes of, the way we view presumption, whether we lump it all together, or do we give electrical a little more weight than something structurally wrong with the heart?
I can address that. This is Karen Levy. And first, I wanted to address, Samson, your first question regarding the 4 months time period. That is a statutory requirement. It appears in Government Code Section 31722. That specifies a 4 month time period in which to file an application. Okay. Regarding the heart presumption, the statute, Government Code Section 31720.5, actually refers to heart trouble. That is the condition that triggers the presumption. As far as specifically your question regarding mechanical conditions, we don't have that information currently today for you. It is a medical analysis. And so when Sisera has a presumption case that involves heart trouble, the medical advisor will review all of the medical records and provide a medical opinion to the board regarding whether the condition qualifies as heart trouble, which is required under the presumption statute. I hope that helps.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks, Karen.
All right. Wait, was that all your questions, Samson?
Yeah. Great. Dennis.
All right.
Yes. Hello. I just have a question about slide 6 for eligibility to file disability application for non-service connected. What if the member has service in two tiers, or I mean, more than two? Say they have 2 years in tier three and then 3 years in tier one. Will those two combine, or do they have to? I mean, how do you determine with multiple tiers? Yeah.
We would use the most recent tier for determining eligibility. So if someone went from tier one to tier three, they're currently in tier three, they would have the hired substantial gainful employment condition or standard to meet. But combined for the benefit calculation, we'd look at all service within SACERA.
Okay. And then if they came from a different agency, those years will count too, right? Or not? Like if they came from CalPERS, or do they have to start over with CSERA?
I'm just thinking of one case that we had that was actually the opposite. Normally, the time has to be with CSERA.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Jerry.
If you go back to slide 9, it's just background here to have as I discuss this point. Can you hear me?
Yes. Son, can you move to slide 9?
It's not imperative, but could you refresh my memory? If you look at some of these, for instance, cancer, blood-borne infectious diseases, these can be devastating things that people are confronted by, and there's no question about that. But in some cases, in fact, an increasing number of cases that we read about, such conditions are curable. People do go into remission from cases of cancer and whatnot, and thank goodness that they do. And same is true of some blood-borne infectious diseases. So if the disabilities, the underlying disabilities that those individuals had that led to an application and action by this board are, for lack of a better word, no longer applicable, could you remind us of the policy we have to be able to go back and double check with someone to find out whether or not they might be rehirable or whether or not they may in fact have assumed a similar role in another location in the United States and we're unaware of that. So they're in that case receiving a disability check from CSERA and also doing possibly the same job they did before in another jurisdiction.
So your comment is the permanency was no longer permanent.
Correct. Especially and perhaps in the cases of younger individuals.
Right. CSERA has a policy in place that allows us to do outreach prior to any disability where the member is under the age of 55. Once they attain age 55, they're excluded from the group, but we have the ability to do outreach to the employer first to see if they have a position for the individual and would take them back, bring them back into employment. If the employer is affirmative on that response, we will contact the disability recipient and let them know that we will be scheduling a medical examination with a specialist to determine if they are fit for duty and if their health condition is still applicable. If it is found that they are still disabled or have the restriction, we'd have a medical report that substantiates that. If they are not, and it comes back, like you mentioned, went into remission and they are fit for duty, we'll then go through the process of suspending their disability benefit and allow, and get them back in contact with the employer. Because the employer, has said they would reinstate them to the position they had.
And might that also extend to a situation in which the person is relocated? Perhaps they were a safety worker in Contra Costa County. They were granted a disability, relocated to someplace else in the United States, and lo and behold, end up holding correct. A similar position in another state, another agency.
Yeah, that is correct. And again, and it's talked about, it is possible. Again, the fire, the sheriff, the fire positions, the safety roles are very physical. And the standard is they're no longer able to do that job because of a permanent impairment. So it is possible that they could do other occupations that do not require them, do not have those type of heavy physical requirements.
Understood. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
All right, any other questions for Tim? I have my gallery back now, Tim.
Great. You're back in charge.
Yeah, I don't want, you were doing just fine. So that's fine with me. I don't see any other hands up. So thank you, Tim, for the report on item 9 of the presentation.